better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining our door.
Come over here, kid. Why, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick.
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. How are you doing this evening? It's Michelle Anna Jordan, and it's great to have celebrated 15 years of Mouthful. Wow. It's also pretty amazing to think it's been that long. Anyway, tonight we have two interviews with Matter Joffrey. The first was recorded last week when she was in town to promote her newest cookbook, At Home with Mater Joffrey. It's a great book. And then following this first interview, we revisit my interview with her in November of 2006 when she was here with her memoir, Climbing Mango Trees, that was first released. It's now available in paperback. So pour yourself a cup of hot chai, sit back, and relax with Mater Joffrey. It's with great pleasure that I welcome Mater Joffrey back to Mouthful. It's so good to see you again.
It's wonderful to be here again.
Now, you were here when Climbing the Mango Trees came
out.
That's
right. Yes. That's right.
And now you have another cookbook. This must be, what, your 18th or...
Oh, whatever.
Yeah, there's a lot.
And there's several of them.
I have to tell you, I love this book. I love your books in general. In fact, I was just going through the one about... Curries to kebabs. Yes, you have a wonderful tea recipe, a very simple, unusual tea from Kashmir in that saffron tea.
Right.
And
right.
I had my little grandson over yesterday. He's 9 now. And he'd had a tough day, and I made him some of that. And
wow,
he just loved it.
Well, you see.
And it's a wonderful...
A child knows a good thing when they drink it.
Yes. And now the book is At Home with Mater Joffrey. So the title suggests that this is very much a personal book.
It is a personal book, and it's a book of simple recipes from not just India, but what used to be India at one time, which includes Pakistan and Bangladesh, and of course, India. And then I've also included... Sri Lanka, which is this little teardrop that hangs at the bottom of India. Mm-hmm. And it's a nation unto itself, but a lot of its food is very like South India. It's a mixture of South Indian food and Southeast Asian food, which makes it really, really so delicious. Now,
is that where some of the ingredients like cilantro and coconut nut milk come in? Because those are things I associate with Southeast Asia.
Well, more than that, lemongrass.
Okay,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, it's very used a lot. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fish used in the food, dried fish, fresh fish. Mm-hmm. So all that is a part of Southeast Asian cooking, and it's a part of Sri Lankan cooking as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, in looking through the book, I was immediately drawn into the appetizers. They're my kind of recipes. seasoned radishes, roasted almonds with black pepper, perfumed almonds, chickpeas for nibbling. These are very fast recipes with a couple of ingredients.
Right.
But huge amounts of flavor.
That's right. And you're in an area with great almonds, for example.
Yes, we are.
And you should make these. And all you do is soak the almonds with a little sugar and a little cardamom. And the next day, you peel them, and they have this glorious cardamom flavor in them.
And cardamom is just such a beautiful,
gorgeous.
Beautiful flavor.
And then you just nibble on them. And there, you see, in India, everything is for health reasons, too. And almonds are considered brain food. So actually, my mother used to make this. She used to soak the almonds, grind them with cardamom and a little sugar and make little balls. And if we had an exam, she would come to us with these almond balls and we would eat them. And we ace the exams.
Now, that is a really, really great tip.
So I grew up with almonds as brain food. So this, to me, has that wonderful... health association as well, as do all the
everything.
Foods in this book.
But now, is it, my impression is that that health aspect is sort of from the bottom up and that it's very intuitive.
It is, and it's, we're not taught it, but we know it because it's done to us all the time. For example, when I was doing this book and I was selecting simple recipes from all these different countries, and I said, you know, I'm not going to cut down on the spicing because the spices are there for health reasons,
mm-hmm.
and each one has a function to perform. For example, all the beans that we eat a lot of beans, much more, 100 times
and
more
than
we
eat. You're talking mostly about dried beans?
Dried legumes, split peas, mm-hmm. that whole family.
Right.
Chickpeas,
lentils, yes.
All that is in the bean family. We nearly always cook them with asafoetida.
Right, I saw that in
and
all the most
digestive.
Of the recipes.
That's a okay. digestive. And that's why we use it. It has a truffle-like, garlic-like aroma, very strong and funky kind of smell. Mm-hmm. But that dissipates.
Mm-hmm.
And all that you get in terms of taste is a deep bottom to the mm-hmm. beans.
Like that base
like
note
base,
almost.
Some uh-huh. bass being played right at the bottom.
Uh-huh.
And you don't know what it is quite, but it's wonderful and it's very Indian. But it is there for a health reason. It's a digestive.
Mm-hmm. And you can find that ingredient in certainly, I think, any Asian market.
That's right.
The
and
Bay
it lasts
Area.
Forever.
Yeah.
You
yeah,
once
I have
you
some
have
in
a
my
little
cupboard.
Tin of it,
uh-huh.
it's there. You have it.
Now, you mentioned beans, legumes, all that sort of thing. So I want to jump ahead to something I wanted to talk about, and that's dal.
Yes.
And I remember when I went to India. It's the first place I ever went in my life other than California.
Yeah.
And suddenly I'm there in this fairly remote little village, and I didn't eat spicy food at the time, and I was overwhelmed. And I ended up living practically every day. I ate rice and dal with sliced tomatoes and cucumbers on the side and a pomegranate for dessert.
Perfect.
And I just came home loving those flavors, and I still do. So talk about dal and the importance
of dal.
Well, you
see, it's very healthy food. When in India you say, have you had your dinner or have you eaten? You'll say, have you had your dal and rice or dal and bread, dal roti? And it means, have you had dinner? Have you eaten? And to us, it's synonymous with food.
Mm-hmm.
And there's almost no major meal without dal or, as we say, legumes or beans. This is dal is a general word for all kinds of beans, split peas, lentils, everything.
Mm-hmm.
They all come under the word dal. And dal shops in India, they don't just, it's not a tiny little shop because you have dal in various forms. For example, if you take mung beans, you have them whole and they're green. You have them split and they're green on the outside and yellowish inside. Then you have them hulled and split. So they're all yellow, but they're split.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have flours made out of mung beans.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we eat them in various ways and they are so full of protein. And so good for you. And when you're trying to eat cheaply, I mean, you see that in Latin America, rice and beans.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just poor man's food. It is good food.
It is
nutritious, cheap, wonderful food. And I think America is home to so many kinds of native beans. And we don't eat them enough. We don't. We really should. They're very good for us.
Yeah, they're very good. And they have a small carbon footprint, you could say.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I love the recipes, just some of them. Rice with mung dal, dal made with red lentils, that was the one that I ate most when I was in India.
The red lentils.
Red lentils.
I see.
And when I came back, I was able to find them.
Now
I think they're easier to find here, but you had to hunt.
Really?
You had to hunt. Unless you got down into San Francisco and Berkeley where there were Asian markets, but up here in Sonoma County, there's never been just a strictly Indian grocery here in Sonoma County, though there are grocery stores that have sections.
But health food stores.
That's where I found them, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Very often will have red lentils and all kinds of beans.
Yeah, and they're very good. Another thing that you have that both reminded me of when I was in India, but also resonates with some things that are going on today, is a goat curry.
I wanted people to know that Indians, the meat in India that we eat every day, it's not lamb, actually, it's goat. And you can buy it. A lot of halal shops that have meat for Muslims who will not eat meat that's butchered in any other way.
Mm-hmm.
Other than, it's like the kosher meat. It's very similar to kosher meat.
Yeah.
And that, what is kosher, is cut in the same way. The meat is killed in the same way. And we eat the goat. We eat goat. And it has a different flavor. It has a different texture. And I want people to know it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to cook it with goat, but I want them to know it. And if they get a chance to buy it, they should. and try cooking it.
And actually, it's getting much more popular today. We have several farmers here in the North Bay who are selling goat along with the other meats they sell.
Right.
And a new book came out. Marisa Gugiana has written a wonderful book called Primal Cuts, Profiles of 50 Butchers Around the Country. And goat is one of the things people are starting to work with.
That's so great to know. And for example, when you do lamb shanks, they're big.
Yeah,
you don't
huge.
Know how to cut the lamb shank for one person. But if you do goat shanks and braise them slowly, they're absolutely wonderful. And you can, it's enough for one person, really. The portions are correct with a smaller animal.
Yes.
Otherwise, you have to really split it in some funny way.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah. So talk to me a little bit more about curry and what makes a curry a curry. I think that a lot of people still in the United States, they still think curry is the spice rather than the technique.
People say, is it made with curry? Or, you know, and also calling it a curry. So the name is both for the spice and for the dish itself, and they're all called curry. I think Indians call every dish, they have a name for every dish. Like, let's say it's goat. Goat cooked with cinnamon and black peppercorns. Goat cooked in this way, or lamb cooked in this way. So we identify it more by the style of cooking than by calling everything a curry, because then that would be too confusing. But when we speak in English, we tend to say the English word, which is curry, which is anything with a sauce, generally a meat, but it could be a vegetable, with a certain kind of sauce that you eat. So that's a general word. But in India, we would not use that general word because dishes are very specific. If it's made with its prawns and cooked in coconut milk, we would describe it as such, you know, rather than calling it a shrimp curry, you know. So that is what a curry is, really just a general anglicized name for a dish with an Indian dish with a sauce. And one of the interesting things that I did in this book in order to get simple recipes, because making a very traditional meat curry involved browning of onion, garlic, ginger, browning of all the spices, browning of the meat, and takes time. And I began thinking that India obviously developed this method because we had no refrigerators, we had no ovens, we had no other techniques to do this. But having all this in the Western world, we can work out other techniques that are simpler. So what I have started doing, and this I've developed really over 50 years, is you take all the meat, let's say you're buying goat locally, and you just put all the spices, the onion, garlic, ginger, all the spices that that dish requires on it. And then you put it in a bag or dish and put it in the refrigerator overnight. So all these wonderful spices are going into the meat. And the next day you take it out, let it come to room temperature, and put it in a baking dish and roast it in the oven till once the top is brown. You're really browning it. Turn the pieces over. The other side is brown. Now you cover it and you braise it. So you're not doing all that stirring and frying that you would for a very traditional curry, yet the results, the end results are the same.
That's really interesting. And, you know, I have a beautiful goat roast in my refrigerator.
Oh.
I was going to make pozole, but I think I'm going to
change
my mind and
make
curry.
There's a dish. There's a dish in this book from Sri Lanka. And it's called beef s'more.
Now you can I was looking at that recipe.
That is incredible recipe. And it's a hunk, it's a pot roast. It's literally a pot roast, which you can do with a goat leg. Is you just brown it, and then you cook it in spices and coconut milk and something sour, which could be vinegar, it could be
lime juice,
lime pickle, any of these things. And it's sweet and sour and hot. And delicious. And I was thinking for Jewish families that don't mix milk with meat, the coconut milk
looks perfect.
Yeah,
what a great
perfect.
Idea.
It's perfect. So I recommend it highly.
Oh, that's
it's a delicious dish. It's actually delicious.
That sounds really good. I'm going to make it as soon as I get home because you're making me very hungry. another dish, we have beautiful okra at the farmer's market right now. And you had, and I think okra... is a hurdle. A lot of people have to get over their prejudice against okra or their bad okra experiences. You have what sounds like a fabulous soup, okra and Swiss chard. Would you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, it is so good. Because okra has that lovely gelatinous quality. Some people don't like it. So there are two things you can do to okra. You can either fry it so it gets crisp. Mm-hmm. And I have a dish like that in the book as well. Or you can sauté it along with other things and blend it all. So you get this gorgeous, gorgeous soup. And this particular one has coconut milk in it. Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful, wonderful way to use okra. And it's so delicious that you'll find – I make it for a lot of my parties. Mm-hmm. This is one of my favorite soups. Uh-huh. And another favorite soup of mine is something that happened around this season several years ago. And I had a whole lot of red peppers in my garden. And the frost hit. We have frost where I come from, upstate New York.
Oh, we have it here too.
Oh, you do. So the frost hit and the plants were like, you know. But the peppers were still fine. So I cut off all the peppers and it was a cold, cold sort of day, unpleasant day. And I said, again, thinking the Indian medicine way, that I have to cook these peppers with something that's going to be good today for this weather. And I cooked it with ginger. And it's a wonderful soup with red pepper and ginger. Again, perfect for people who have cold, perfect for change of the seasons. We in India, you feel that a lot of illnesses start in this change of season time because people don't dress properly, they're not careful, the thing is too warm and it's too cold, the thing is too cold and it's too warm, and they go from one to the other. So they're dishes to protect you at this time of year. So this particular soup is one that will protect you in this time of year that has a lot of ginger in it.
Oh, and ginger is so good, and we so need protection at this time of year. You know, flu season is just about
That's exactly it. That's it. That's the...
You mentioned you cook that soup for a lot of your parties.
Yeah.
And that, anticipating my next question, do you do a lot of entertaining?
I do. Yeah. I do.
And you live in upstate New York?
Yes, we have a house in upstate. Okay. We have an apartment where I don't entertain too much.
The apartment's in Manhattan.
Manhattan.
Yeah,
but in upstate New York, and actually in this book, all the pictures are taken in my house in the country.
Oh.
And every pot and pan you see is in the book is from my house. It's part of the – I love collecting pots and pans. Plates, and I love all that. So anyway, so I love to entertain there because there's more space, and
sure.
I can have a dining room, which I don't actually in the city. And I like to make things that don't take forever to cook, like we all do, but that tastes marvelous. So everything in this book has come from dinners and meals that I've cooked in the country. Okay. That's why it's called At Home with Mother Jaffe. And because this is how I like to cook.
Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons it's so instantly engaging. I mean, you just step into this book and there you are being fed. and, you know, it's really wonderful. I love it. Going to change the subject a little bit now, though, because you are on Facebook.
Yes.
And
well, I'm not on Facebook, but I Twitter.
Oh, no. Somebody mentioned you on Facebook.
Oh,
that's
okay.
What it was.
Yes.
And another friend, Marcella Hassan.
Yes.
She's very active on Facebook.
Oh, is she?
She is a dynamo.
Oh.
Giving her opinions and advice. And,
right.
I mean, she's so wonderful.
I love her books.
Someone quoted you about the classic Italian cookbook.
Yes.
It should be on every cook's shelf. And I
Absolutely.
Just wanted to ask you about that.
I think I have – the cookbooks I actually use on daily basis, a weekly basis. I could count on my one hand.
Mm-hmm.
And hers is certainly one of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's so well written. It explains everything. It doesn't try and dull the taste of what Italian food should be.
Mm-hmm.
And she gives you in detail how you make it. So to me, that is a great book.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was just very pleased that somebody had come across, you know, you saying that, and that Marcella got involved in the conversation.
Oh,
it was just a pleasure. And I think it all made her feel so good because so many people posted a response to your comment.
Yes.
And she was just, for that day, she was just showered with love and praise. It was very sweet.
Good. I'm so happy.
Another thing that you have done, you've written several books for children.
Yes.
Yes. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it started when I was too busy when my three daughters were young. And I would tell them stories, but I would tell them stories from Indian history, which excited me at that particular time. And I thought they should really know about ancient Indian history and medieval Indian history and Indian history from the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. So I would tell them a lot of the real stories about real people, but historical figures. Mm-hmm. And I never really told them the mythological stories about India. I was so busy telling stories about real people. Then when my grandkids started coming, I thought, they need to know all this part of my culture. Mm-hmm. And I started collecting stories that were told in my family. They're very specific to my family. And I went to my old aunts who were already in their 80s. And we have an oral tradition. We had a very sort of actory kind of group as a family. Mm-hmm. People love telling tales. They love music. They love singing. And they love historical tales and mythological tales. And those are told at every religious festival. So I said I should just record my aunts telling these stories, mm-hmm, and translate them and give a context to them, say why they're told, when they're told, and put it down in a book. I had no idea that a lot of people would be so interested. So that was my first book, Seasons of Splendor for Children. And people have just responded very well, because they're tales very specific to my family, told in a certain way, mm-hmm, in an oral tradition.
Wonderful. Really, really wonderful. I think you must be one of those people who you have more hours in the day than the average person. I would like to have that as well. Are you doing any teaching in conjunction with this?
Okay. I'm not doing any teaching other than demos at various places, uh-huh, that I am doing. But I've stopped teaching because I feel I'm writing the cookbooks. I'm cooking on television, which is a kind of teaching. Mm-hmm. And it reaches many more people because I used to hold. Mm-hmm. My cooking classes were for four people, you know, because it was hands-on. Do this, do it again. You haven't got it right. And let's do it one, uh-huh, more time to just smooth out the edges. Uh-huh. And there were three-hour classes, four-hour classes, and they were very hands-on. And I was doing all the shopping and the cooking and the, mm-hmm, cleaning up afterwards.
So much work.
It is a lot of work. And I thought, really, this is a better way. It's just write books, do
reach
it on television,
people.
Reach more people. Uh-huh. Yeah.
You also, in your spare time perhaps, you're also an accomplished actor.
Yes.
Do you have anything coming up?
I do.
Oh, tell
us. I do. I have a film opening on the 11th of November. It's called Today's Special. And it's been written by, and the main lead is played by a young man called Asif Manvi. He plays my son. And he's on Today's Special. He's on The Daily Show, if you've seen.
Oh, okay.
He's
a
young Indian comedian on The Daily Show. Uh-huh. So he's been trying to do this independent film for the last 10 years. And finally he raised enough money and did it. And now it's getting distribution. So it's really a great, great day for all of us. And it's called Today's Special, and it should be opening in November all over the country.
Oh, that's just great. And then I came across you also on an episode of Law and Order.
Yeah, episode of Law and Order, episode of Psych. I'm on and off in various, uh-huh, other shows.
Uh-huh. That's just great. It's really, I really enjoy that overlap.
Yeah,
it's knowing
nice
you
me.
Through your food, but then also seeing you in this other capacity. I just find it very engaging.
Well, good. I can't do without it. I need that, uh-huh, very much.
That's just great. When did you start your career as an actor?
That's how I started.
Oh, that's
I started
how you,
acting
before cooking.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I started acting when I was five. Played a brown mouse in the school musical, uh-huh, and have acted all the way, first playing boys' parts in schools. I played Robin Hood. I played Hamlet. Mm-hmm. And then I joined an amateur theater. I've done radio since I was 10. And we lived very near the radio station when I was a kid. And all the children in our family were considered quite really good at radio. So whenever there was anything where they needed children, we were called to the radio station. So I've been on radio since I was probably about 8 or so. And then eventually I was a disc jockey on radio.
Oh, you were? Where?
Yeah, in India, in Delhi.
Oh, oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, this is All India Radio Delhi, and so on and so forth. Uh-huh. And then I was did amateur theatre, and then I went to RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in England, to study theatre. And I graduated from there and came to America because I wanted to be like Marlon Brando. I thought, oh, that's acting. That's real acting. And it was very hard to find work.
Oh, it was.
As an Indian. So I started writing. That was one other means to make a living. And I was writing pieces for magazines, for newspapers. And I just happened to write one piece on the foods I grew up with as a child. And that sort of took
and
off.
What publication was that?
That was a magazine then called Holiday. It doesn't exist now. But it was a magazine, and the secretary who was working there at that time is now the editor-in-chief of Town and Country. I mean, we've all grown over time, and we all have known each other for a very long time. And I started writing, and then the cookbook, the first cookbook came about because Ismail Merchant, who was part of Merchant Ivory Productions, we had done a film, my first film, called Shakespeare Wala. And in order to sell the film, he approached Craig Claiborne, who was the food writer for the New York Times, and said, you must do a piece on this actress who likes to cook. So Craig did a whole piece on me. It was one page long, big. It was huge. And on the basis of that one piece, I was approached by an editor who said, would you like to do a cookbook? And it never worked out with him, but I ended up with Judith Jones.
Judith Jones, yes.
Who was at Knopf, with whom I ended up doing my first cookbook, and I was very lucky.
Oh, that is such a great story. And the book is marvelous, too. And I know that you are on the road. You've got several events, I think, scheduled today. We're going to let you go.
Thank you.
It's been so wonderful to see you again, and I really look forward to the next book.
Well, thank you. Enjoy this one.
Oh, you can be sure. So, Madhur Jaffrey, the book is At Home with Madhur Jaffrey, Simple Delectable Dishes from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Delicious. You're listening to KRCB-FM. It's Mouthful. Now we're going to hear from Madhur Jaffrey. At the time her memoir, Climbing Mango Trees, was first released, the book is really interesting, not just for her personal story, which I find fascinating, but also for the glimpse of history it gives us to this particular part of the world, northern India. Madhur Jaffrey has been writing about Indian cooking since the 1970s. She's also an acclaimed actor. You may have seen her, for example, in Law & Order. Now she's on tour for an exquisite memoir, Climbing the Mango Tree. Madhur, welcome to Mouthful. It is really great to be able to talk with you. I've loved your work, and I just got home from Portugal myself fairly recently, and your book was waiting for me, Climbing the Mango Tree. And it just came out this month, October.
It came out on the 10th of October.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to write it?
Well, actually, it didn't take me very long. I thought, first of all, when I was asked to do it by my editor, I thought, I can't remember what happened yesterday. How am I going to remember what happened so many years ago in my life? But somehow, when I sat down to write, it all came out in gushes, and a lot of it came out in large chunks. And in fact, I had to then decide what to leave out because there was too much that was coming back into my head.
The book has that sense about it. It has that feel of momentum. You know, from a reader's point of view, it's a page-turner. And I like that about it. I like that about a memoir. It doesn't feel like you're grasping to tell the story. It just feels like that story is coming out through you. And it's a pretty remarkable story, growing up in Delhi.
And I'm certainly growing up in a very strange time that has not been written about all that much, because I was born when India was a colony. And then I lived through the time when India became independent. And India was partitioned at the same time. So that was a big horror, because a million people were killed during the time of partition.
Yeah, so, and that was happening, Independence Day was just a couple days after your 14th birthday.
That's right, that's
right. So that must have been such, I mean, it's a tumultuous time for any
girl. Very tumultuous, because A, you're growing up, you're not sure of you're not a grown up, you're not a child. And I was struggling with school at that time because I was learning a new language in school. And at the same time, the people were dying all over the country. And I was growing up. So all these things together were rather traumatic at that time. Mm-hmm.
Did your life at that time change significantly forever? Or was it interrupted by the turmoil and then sort of went back to how it had
been?
It
changed. Mm-hmm. I think my city changed. Mm-hmm. And we were so much, our family is an old Delhi family. We've been there for centuries and centuries. And Delhi became another city mm-hmm. after independence. It had about 750,000 people in it before. And then after independence, now we are 16 million people. So it became a large city with a lot of refugees. And the refugees, particularly from the Punjab, became the citizens of the city more so. And we were very few. The Delhiwalas, the Delhi people, were just a few people left in the city. So that changed forever and ever. And half my class in my particular school were Muslims. And they left and went to Pakistan. And I never saw them again. So that was an enormous change. It's hard to accept that mm-hmm. something could break. And I felt that my heart had broken. Not the country had broken, but my heart mm-hmm. had broken. It was a very personal way of looking at it, but I'm sure many Indians felt that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, before that time, and you talk about the house, you lived in an extended family. Reading the descriptions of breakfast, I was trying to keep track of how many people were around the table, and I couldn't.
Well, my grandfather had 8 children, and each of his children had lots of grandchildren, so we were never less than 40 people at a meal. I mean, if some people were away, it would be 30 people. Mm-hmm. And what happened in the dining room, which was a long room, it started off with a big dining table with chairs, proper chairs for all the grown-ups, and then another table was added to it. And then as the children got born, more and more of them, they added a third table with benches all around. So it was a very – I really didn't know what was happening at the other end of the table. I didn't know till about 5 or 6 years ago that my grandmother was a vegetarian, and she was eating at the other end.
At the same table.
Oh, at the same table, though.
That's so interesting. Now, one of the things that is really enchanting in the book is the family book that you talk about that chronicles the family with a lot of detail, and then that book disappears for a really long time. Could you talk about that?
You know, India has a caste system, which, of course, is not a legal caste system now. We are not supposed to recognize it according to our law, but it still exists. And this caste system was formed at least 2,000 years ago, if not longer ago. And at the same time as the caste system was formed, I think one group of people broke apart from this regular caste system. And I'm sure people, our particular clan said, we want to read and write, but we don't want to be priests, because in those days only priests could read and write. And we don't want to read and write religion only. We want to read and write what we want to read and write. And we became a caste of scribes, writers. And that's what we stayed all along. So all this was in the history book. And the actual history started in the 17th century and then went from there to the present time. It was all written down. And I just found that particular book by accident because my grandfather was a barrister and he had a little law office at home. And I used to wander around there because by this time he was quite old and I would go and look at the books of knowledge and look at all kinds of other things in his office. And one day I was wandering around in his office and I spotted this red book sitting among in the bookshelf. And I pulled the book out and I started reading it. And, of course, in school we were reading English history, British history, and Indian history. And then suddenly I saw this book and I said, well, this is British history, it's Indian history, this is my story, it's my very personal history. And I was fascinated. I would go back again and again and keep reading this book till I'd read the whole thing. And then after my grandfather died, this particular book, I don't know what happened to it, but it disappeared. I think one of the aunts sold off to the rubbish man everything that was in my grandfather's library. Nobody wanted his law books, and they were just sold. And this book disappeared, and I didn't find it again till about 10 years ago. And it wasn't that book. It was a reprint of that particular book.
And do you know why the book was reprinted? How did that come about?
This is it's a mystery to me. I don't know who had it reprinted, but obviously it's in various libraries because there's another writer. I just met him in Bali, a writer called William Dalrymple. I don't know if you know his name. He is writing a book on the Indian Mutiny of 1857, and he used my grandfather's grandfather's book. He's the one who wrote this book as a source. He used it as a source for his book. So this must be, I said, where did you get it? Because I had such trouble finding it. He said, oh, it was there in a library. So it obviously exists as some kind of record in some place, this particular book. But it was written by my grandfather's grandfather. And he went back in history as he wrote it, and he went forwards in history. And he wrote it at a time when the mutiny was going on, which was a famous war in India. Mm-hmm. It was our first war of independence in 1857. And he was living at that time, and he wrote a daily diary of that period, which is fantastic to read.
Yeah, and it's amazing that after all those years, it made its way back to you.
Yeah,
it is amazing. That's one of the parts I really loved in the book. Of course, one of the things in the book is the way food forms such a thread through both your life as a child and your adult life as you remember it. And I'm wondering if you could talk to us about honey and the importance of honey.
Well, the custom in my particular family was, and we were all born at home at that time, we were delivered at home, as they said. And as soon as a child was born, my grandmother would come into the room with a jar of honey, and she would dip her little finger in honey and write Om, which means I am, on the tongue with honey. And my mother always tells the story. She said, of course, most people, children just licked it once, and you just kept licking it and then opened your mouth for more. So honey has been a part of my infancy, my very start of life from, you know, right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then when it came for my father to name me, which usually happens about a month after you're born, the priest usually names a child according to the horoscope. They look at this big scroll of paper, they open it up, and there are all kinds of letters and numbers, and they find from that what you should be named. And the priest decided that I should be named Queen of the Heavens, Goddess of the Heavens. And my father said, no, she's going to be called Madhur, which means sweet as honey. So in a way, the honey theme just continued through my life.
Mm-hmm. Now, was anyone in your family a beekeeper? Did you have that side of
things? No. No beekeepers.
No beekeepers. Just a thought that popped into my head. Now, as you were growing up in your earliest years, were you an eager, adventurous eater from the start?
Yes, always. I love to taste things. Everything. I like sweet things. I like sour things. Certainly as a child, I like spicy things. I like new things. Whatever new was coming in from anywhere, I would want to try it. Mm-hmm. And I think as I look back on my life, and I say, why am I doing what I'm doing? Why did I choose it? I think from the very beginning, I must have had a good palate. Mm-hmm. So tastes were being catalogued somewhere in my head. And there they remained, because the brain is like a computer. If you put in things, they're there. You may not be able to retrieve them, but they're there. Mm-hmm. So I think I was cataloging all these tastes, and the palate must have been pretty active and sure of itself from a very early age.
When did you, as an adult, start accessing those memories and start using them to sort of navigate both to learn teaching yourself to cook and also to using them to trigger memory?
I think it first started when I was in England. I was in my early 20s, and I had finished college in Delhi, and I wanted to study drama, and I was going to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London. And this was the late 50s, and the food was horrible, and there was smog, and, you know, London was not the most exciting of places in some ways. In other ways, it was. And I was desperate for good Indian food and home food, because that's what I remembered. And then I began, my mother sent me letters, and I started with recipes. So I started cooking. And cooking one dish at a time. And my mother's recipes were a little bit of this and a little bit of that. But that's when I think I first began drawing on the taste that I remembered. Because it's not always easy to reproduce a dish based on a little bit of this and a little bit of that. But I think the remembered tastes began coming back. Mm-hmm. So if it wasn't right, I knew what was missing.
Yeah, you knew sort of how to get there intuitively.
Yeah. So that was, I think, the very first time that I began using the taste memory, as it were. And then when I came to America and got married and had kids, I desperately needed work. And there was, as an actress, I was not getting much work. And then I thought, well, just to keep things going, just to have some money, I'll write. So I started writing for magazines and newspapers. And what I was writing about was what I knew, which was the arts, music, food, drama, theater, dance, painting, sculpture, mm-hmm. things like that. And then I also happened to write about food. And that article just started something. And then more and more people asked me to write about food. And then again, I was in a way forced to think back and remember, because I was writing about, I didn't know much mm-hmm. about food other than what I'd eaten. So initially, I wrote pieces that were really memory mm-hmm. pieces about Indian food. So the process of thinking about it mm-hmm. started much earlier. And I think that helped the book to come out in the rush that it did, because I'd already started part of the process, mm-hmm. but I hadn't really gone into my life in detail, but mm-hmm. I had started the process of thinking about mm-hmm. it.
You know, it sounds in a lot of ways very much like M.F.K. Fisher.
Yeah.
Who people who are in the food world and go back and read her today, they come away often saying, well, she didn't really know much about food, it's like, but she knew much about life. You know, that's what she's doing. She's speaking from her heart. And you do very much the same thing in that you tell such a compelling story. And we're humans and we eat every day. Yeah. So it's inevitable that that's going to be wound up with it. I'm wondering if, mm-hmm. as a girl living in the class that you did, if there were any food restrictions that came with your position in society, were you allowed to go and eat in the first place I ever went, I should tell you, first place I ever went after California was Bombay.
Yeah.
And it was quite a shock, but my palate has really been shaped by that experience. And so I'm just wondering, could you eat the street food? Could you go out and participate in that way?
We weren't allowed to eat street food mm-hmm. because it was not clean. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were such contradictions in our lives. Mm-hmm. We were told, don't go out and eat the street food. It's not clean. However, if the street food vendor was brought into our dining room, and he would set up the vending stand in our dining mm-hmm. room, it was all right. So there were these horrible contradictions constantly. Mm-hmm. Then my father and all his lot loved the kebabs, the Muslim foods mm-hmm. that were behind the great big mosque in Delhi. And again, our very clean driver would go, and my mother would give him these clean napkins and a clean little basket and our own plates. And he would go to these very dirty stalls behind the Jama Masjid, which is the mosque in Delhi, and buy all these foods, which are not clean. And they would have raw onions on them, which we weren't allowed to eat in the outside at all because they were raw. And he would bring them. But once they were on our clean plates, with our clean napkins, it was all right. And we ate them. So we lived with these strange contradictions. So we officially didn't eat outside food, but unofficially we did.
Unofficially, yes. Yes. And who did the cooking for your big extended family?
We had cooks mm-hmm. that did it. But if there was a picnic, mm-hmm. then the women of the house would buzz around and start mm-hmm. cooking, all of them together. And if we were pickling, if there were pickling days, mm-hmm. then they would all sit in the sun and pickle for hours and hours and hours. And if there was a religious festival, then they would all cook the foods of the religious festival together. So there were certain activities that the women did, and sometimes they would start the food. Mm-hmm. If they weren't sure if the cook knew how to make a particular dish, they'd start it, but then leave it for him to finish off.
Mm-hmm. And did you spend any time in the kitchen while you were?
No. I just went in, sniffed around, and came out again, waiting for my meal. So it was really a great change when I had to cook for myself mm-hmm. because I had really no knowledge of the basics of cooking.
Yeah, so you really had to find your way back through that
through
simple taste
memory.
Yes, through taste. That's really interesting. I know you won James Beard Award, and I believe it was 1991 or 1993.
I've won quite a few of them,
yes,
actually, several books.
So when did your first book come out?
1973. It was a Knopf book.
Okay.
And it was 1973, and it was an invitation to Indian cooking. And the reason why that happened was that I was doing a film called Shakespeare Wala. And the New York Times food writer was a gentleman called Craig Claiborne. Mm-hmm. And Craig had done a piece on me as an actress who likes to cook. So he had written a piece on that. And on the basis of that piece, I'd been approached by a freelance editor, and they said, would you like to do an Indian cookbook? Well, that didn't quite pan out, and eventually I sold the book to Knopf, and they bought it. And so that's how that particular book, you know.
And in 1973, there were not that many Indian cookbooks in
none.
America. You
there
couldn't
were, there
find
were,
those.
I think, they, well, there may have been one or two floating around, but there really weren't any. And my book, because I was writing as somebody who'd learnt it, it wasn't something who grew up with cooking. And I wrote for people who knew as little as I did. And I wanted to be sure that they would understand, as I had to understand, how every little bit should look like and taste like at every stage of the cooking. And I think that may be the reason my books have sold well, because I really write very carefully, and I'm a one-woman band. I don't have people who shop for me, clean for me. I shop, I cook, I write the recipe in rough, I put it in the computer, and if there's a mistake, it's mine.
And just so people can, you sort of take them by the hand, they can cook, rather than that sort of armchair style of cookbook we see out today, where it's fun to read, but you don't have six sous chefs in your kitchen, so you may not do it. Let's talk a little bit about a typical Indian meal. For me, and I'm sure in part it is what I was introduced to when I was in India, and what I came to be introduced to after, is I'm used to lots of condiments. It's almost like you have maybe the sun and then all these little planets of condiments circulating
you've
around
got it.
It.
Absolutely right. So what the meal will, the meal of course is balanced, and it's balanced in terms of the proteins and the carbohydrates, but it's also the spices are all the, have the properties that Ayurvedic medicine have given them, and they're heating, they're cooling. So it's balanced also with the spices. And then a meal may have, it depends on where you come from, but it may have rice, it may have meat, or it may not have meat. It may have two or three vegetables. It will definitely have some kind of split peas or dal, as we call them. And there'll be yogurt. But then, as you said, the planets come into play. And the planets are the chutneys and relishes, and they're fresh chutneys, they're preserved chutneys, which are sweet ones that you're more familiar with in this country. And then they're all the pickles. So when you're eating, every bite can be varied according to what chutney or pickle you have with it. So you may have a little bit of rice and a little bit of, let's say, okra. And then you will have it with a green chutney, a fresh green mint chutney. And then if you have the same thing with a sweet chutney or with a pickle, it'll taste different. So within that little framework, and you might have only two dishes that you're eating, but because of all the condiments and the relishes, each taste will be a little, have sparkling differences in it.
Yes, you're making me hungry. One of the things that you do in the book that I really like, for several reasons, is that you've organized it so that all the recipes are in a final section after the epilogue. What made you decide to do it that way?
Well, first of all, I didn't want recipes in this book. I just wanted it to be a memoir. But my publishers,
yes, they all want recipes these days,
had other ideas. So then I said, all right, let's have them all together, but at the end. So they read the story as a story, and then if they want the recipes, they're there. And the recipes are the things that I grew up. The book covers about 18 years of my life, and these are the things that I grew up eating during these 18 years.
Well, I like the fact that the recipes don't interrupt the story. It's the story is so compelling and so interesting that it's good. You can then take the book into the kitchen when you're done reading
yeah,
it.
Yeah, exactly.
And,
that was
and
my
do
idea,
some cooking.
Actually.
Yes.
Yes, exactly that.
There's one recipe I want you to talk about, the little fritters with yogurt.
Oh, yeah. This was something that we all loved. And this was also a street food, but it was also made at home. And what the two oldest beans that have grown in India since antiquity are the mung bean, which is what you make mung bean sprouts. The sprouts are made from the mung bean, and that went from India to China. So that's native to India, and it's a very old bean. And the other is the little black, the one that I was talking about, the black bean that the Punjabis eat. So that's another bean that's also native to India. And now what was your question again? I'm sorry, I'm getting distracted here.
Oh, now I have to remember what my question was. I was so engaged in what you were saying.
The fritters. The little fritters.
Yes.
So we try and use beans very often at the same meal. You might have dried beans in two or three forms that are totally different mm-hmm. from each other. So with a meal, you might have dal with your rice or bread, which is the split pea cooked like a stewy, in a stewy mm-hmm. way. But you might also have fritters in yogurt made with the same beans. And the fritters are, you just grind them coarsely, put spices in the beans. You have to soak them first and then fry them into little fritters. And then we usually put them in a little water to get all the oil out and then put them into yogurt like dumplings. And that we eat along with the meal because yogurt, all the milky foods, mm-hmm. are an essential part of India. It is very strange that we border Southeast Asia and East Asia and China, and they can't eat too much dairy, mm-hmm. whereas we are raised on dairy. And I have a little section in the book where I say we are a milky nation, and without milk, we just wither away and die mm-hmm. because we make yogurt, we make cheeses, fresh cheeses, paneer, mm-hmm. we make lassis, which are drinks. We do everything with milk as a base.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't know what to make of Indian food without the yogurt.
Yes, it is an essential part.
Yeah, absolutely essential. So you've written how many books altogether?
Well, you know, I don't know.
You don't know. You lost count.
Because they keep taking bits of my book and putting them together in a new form with a few new recipes. And then I don't recognize. Somebody mm-hmm. brought a book in yesterday for me to sign. And I said, what is this? It says, it's your book. I said, oh, I've never seen this version mm-hmm. of it. So I just don't know. But I say roughly 15 mm-hmm. cookbooks and maybe 3 children's books and a few other put together books that people have done.
Now tell us about the children's books.
The first one I did, it's called The first one is Seasons of Splendor. And it was, my children were growing up and I realized that I hadn't told them the stories that I had grown up with. And all the family could be actors. You know, we love telling stories. That's part of our tradition. We are word people. We love words. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of poetry recitals in the family, a lot of telling of stories, and we grew up that way. And because we were such a large family, it wasn't a mother with 2 children in bed telling them a bedtime story. Ours mm-hmm. was the huddle. You know, there'd be a whole one elder telling the story and 30, 40 people around children mm-hmm. squirming and on the backs of sofas and on the carpet and all over listening to the story. And the stories they told, some of them were about our own family and our heritage, but others were about the religion, about Hinduism, about the gods. But there were stories told in a particular way in our particular community that made them local and topical and of the times. So if it was a story of somebody eating a meal, they would go into great descriptions of the meal. And this, everyone improvised this. And it would be something that we probably just had. So it made it sound very mouth-watering. So it was a way of storytelling. Mm-hmm. And all these stories existed, and I'd heard them all my life. And I said, they're not being recorded. Who's going to know these stories? And all of us, we're marrying outside. We're marrying other people from other cultures. And these stories will just die. Mm-hmm. So I taped my aunts. And of course, they were telling the stories in Hindi. I taped a lot of my aunts who were then in their 80s and have since died. And I'm so glad I have the stories. And then I translated them and had the book was illustrated. Mm-hmm. And those were the first stories that I wrote. Mm-hmm. The stories.
That's so great. You were able to record your aunts. I was wondering if anyone had captured that. It sounds like great storytelling.
Yeah.
So you have a really interesting career as a mother, as an author of cookbooks and children's books, and also as both a stage and film actress. Did somebody give you 12 extra hours in every day?
No, there's never enough time. I'm just always running around. But it is a life I've chosen. Mm-hmm. And I find it very fulfilling. And I wouldn't change anything at all. Mm-hmm. I love it. And when I'm doing what I do feel, you know, it's like a cup that's full to the top and you feel, and I'm not happy until everything is to the brim and my senses are completely engrossed and involved, and then I'm happy.
Mm-hmm. And you've made us happy with this book, which is certainly full to the brim as well. Do you have new projects in the works?
I always do, mm-hmm. and there's always a cookbook. Mm-hmm. And I'm writing a novel. I'm working on a novel. Mm-hmm. And I write columns for magazines. Mm-hmm. I still write for Gourmet and Savour, mm-hmm. and I write for the Financial Times. So I run around doing pieces for them mm-hmm. at the same time.
And acting?
Acting
in the works right now?
Coming out.
Oh, what, and what's that?
It's called Hiding Divya. It's a wonderful film written by a very young person who's also directed it. And it's about madness. Actually, mental illness is a better word. I shouldn't say madness. Mental illness in the Indian community in New Jersey. It's set in New Jersey, filmed in New Jersey. And it's written by a girl who's half Filipino and half South Asian Muslim. And she's written the script, which is incredible. It's not a heavy script. It's a very light script full of fun and jokes, but it's about a very serious subject, mm-hmm. how mental illness is kept hidden and people don't want to acknowledge it and how difficult it is mm-hmm. and how what pain it brings to families.
Mm-hmm. And that's Hiding Divya?
Divya.
And when will it be out?
It's going to be shown in 2 weeks, actually.
Oh, okay. So
in New York, but I don't know where.
It's
being shown at a film festival, mm-hmm. but I don't know if it's found a release yet mm-hmm. officially.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Well, it's been really wonderful to chat with you. And before I let you go, I can't resist asking you to read some of the book. This is the final narrative before the recipes.
This is the very end of the book, in which I don't even know how to describe it. It's really an epilogue to the book. And this is about the time when I was leaving India to go to London and study drama at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. I knew less than the rudimentaries of cooking then, and found myself writing home to my mother, begging her to teach me what she did, which she did through her airmail letters that arrived regularly in the post. I hardly knew that my old and new worlds would start to mingle as soon as they touched, and that so much of my past, would always remain my present. The innocent Indian honey of my infancy was now mixed with the pungencies of Indian spices, the sour and bitter, the nutty, and the tinglingly aromatic. Births, deaths, illnesses, caste and creed had woven their way through the flavors like tenacious creepers, and yet, somewhere in my depths, each bite, each taste of all I'd eaten, lay catalogued in some pristine file, ready to be drawn up when the moment was ripe.
Madhur Jaffrey, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Mouthful. Be sure to meet me back here next week for another yummy episode of The Most Delicious Hour. In the meantime, you know, you can always go to Facebook and like Mouthful. You can also, if you like to either re-listen to it or want to tell someone else about it, you can go to iTunes and subscribe for free. And when that happens, it is automatically delivered to your podcast file in iTunes. See you next week.
To the Lord, let praises be. It's time for dinner now. Let's go eat. We got some beans and some good cornbread. It's time for dinner now, let's go. We got some beans and some good cornbread. Now listen to what the preacher says.
To the Lord, let praise be.
Let it be.
It's time for dinner now, it's gooey.
We got some beans
and good cornbread.
Good cornbread.
Listen to what the
Mouthful
preacher
is hosted and produced by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast at krcb.org or from iTunes.